May the light we now kindle inspire us to heal, help, serve, and to search for the light that is within each one of us.
Love grows right now when I smile with you. Our hearts expand in the light of this room. These eyes are widening eyes, and I know this voice defines the cries of my soul. My heart is truly beginning to bloom. Love grows right now when I smile with you. Our hearts expand in the light of this room. These eyes are widening eyes, and I know this voice defines the cries of my soul. My heart is truly beginning to bloom. Let's open the windows and open the doors and notice the moment like never before. Break through the barriers and reach out a hand and offer peace to a stranger or friend. We'll raise the whole building and rise up above from the part of us that feels and knows how to love. And we'll sing of the goodness and speak of the truth, and the joy in our hearts will enlighten this room. No matter your struggle, no matter your pain, there's a love right now that's bringing on a change. So open your eyes and take in the view, 'cause right now I'm smiling with you. Right now I'm smiling. Right now I'm smiling. Right now I'm smiling. Love grows right now when I smile with you. Our hearts expand in the light of this room. These eyes are widening eyes, and I know this voice defines the cries of my soul. My heart is truly beginning to bloom. My heart is truly beginning.
We come from all the separate places of our lives to this hour, from love and grief, hope and worry, solitude and activity, to seek renewal and find celebration. Lifting a cloud of daily concerns, pleasures and pains, we pause to give thanks, to feel wonder, and to experience the privilege of living. Come, let us worship together and symbolize our community by joining voices in song.
As I mentioned before, our children are going off to Costa Rica today, so this is the point we sing as we always do and wish bon voyage to our young ones.
Today we celebrate Father's Day. For some, this is an easy and happy celebration, and for others, it can be a bit more complicated. So we each celebrate and honor Father's Day in our own ways, but may we also honor all the people in our lives that have played a father-type role for us, guiding, nurturing, teaching, encouraging us, and sometimes at critical points in our lives.
With each breath, may we be aware of sharing breath with everyone in the room, with everyone on the planet, each of us feeling at times loss, anxiety, pain, each of us feeling at times joy, exuberation, and simple contentment. Instead of hot, muggy air, may we think of it as refulgent, juicy life coming in and out, mindful that this is a season that encourages growth in the nourishment that we need in the cold and restful season that will inevitably follow. May we be mindful of these cycles of life, cycles of breath, and of our togetherness, and help each other carry our heavy burdens and join in celebration with our joys. Amen.
In the order of service, my daughter Hallie and I will sing one of my father's favorite hymns, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing.
My heart, oh.
sometimes things don't go, after all, from bad to worse. Some years, muscadel faces down frost. Green thrives, the crops don't fail. Sometimes a man aims high and all goes well. A people sometimes will step back from war, elect an honest man, decide they care enough that they can't leave some stranger poor. Some men become what they were born for. Sometimes our best efforts do not go amiss. Sometimes we do as we meant to. The sun will sometimes melt a field of sorrow that seemed hard frozen. May it happen for you.
Contentment is tricky. It's hard. It takes continual practice. Just telling someone to be content has little to zero effect. And how do we balance striving for improvement with contentment? When does contentment become apathy? I remember as a child my parents telling me in one breath, try harder, do better, and the next breath, be satisfied. Once when I was small, we visited a relative who had this famous framed quote hanging on a wall. God grant me the serenity to accept what I cannot change, the courage to change what I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It made a profound impact on me, and I can still see it in my mind's eye today, the little red rose embroidered by the word serenity, the lion by courage, and the book by wisdom. I remember standing there thinking, wow, that's exactly it. And I also thought to myself, wow, this must be a pretty common problem. As I grew up, I found that I was really good at the second part, being a type A personality. And when I see something that needs fixing, I can really go after it, perhaps a little too well. And that third one, that's also fairly easy. If I really pause and think about it and pay attention, it becomes obvious what is something I can change and what is not. But that first part, accepting what I cannot change, has proved to be a bit more of a challenge. For me personally, it doesn't relate so much to stuff. I'm not in need of finding contentment with house or car or clothes because I tend not to be someone who places high value on material things. Instead, it's that type A personality again that likes to control her environment. I want things to be peaceful and tranquil at all times, but this tranquility gets constantly disturbed by the waves of life. There's been a long history of me fighting those waves, and the more I fight, the more I get knocked down. As a marketing professional, I often think in terms of taglines. So if my spiritual practice had a tagline, it would be something like, learning to ride the waves. So how do we accept the things that we cannot change? Again, a type A personality likes to make lists. So here's my list on how we accept the things we cannot change. One, you have to accept it. You have no choice other than being miserable and fighting something over which you have no control. And there are countless things that will fall into that category. It actually becomes quite freeing at some level, the detachment, the surrender that comes with realizing you cannot fix every problem. Scary, but freeing. Avoid comparison. Comparing to others will get us into trouble every time. Everyone has a path, and we cannot project onto them. We cannot begin to understand someone else's work. And we also have our own path right in front of us. It's impossible to trade our work for someone else's. The Bhagavad Gita states, it is far better to do one's own work poorly than to do someone else's very well. And have a gratitude practice. It's helpful in breaking the cycle of looking at what isn't there. The more we look for what we lack, the more we see what we lack. We can never increase happiness by adding things to life. Happiness researchers, and they're out there, it's a whole field of happiness research, they've proven repeatedly that once our basic needs are met, there's absolutely no change in the levels of happiness with increased income. Happiness will only come from turning that lens inward. One way that I try and practice gratitude is with my pre-meal prayers. I'd like to spend a few moments thinking about everything that went into bringing that delicious nourishment to me from the plants that selflessly produced fruit, not for themselves, but for somebody else's enjoyment. The farmers, whom I'll never meet. Well, I might meet them at the farmer's market. The truckers, the truck drivers, the store workers, if somebody happened to cook it for you, but I end up being the cook. All the things that go into all these blessings in our lives. Establish an awareness practice. Things and experiences come and go. Emotions and sensations peak and dissipate. If we attach to or identify with these experiences, we'll never be content because all these things bring only temporary pleasure. My awareness practice comes in the form of meditation and self-study, and it helps me to see the waves from a stable vantage point. But awareness practices can come in all different shapes and sizes. When my son was small, he would get really disturbed by any injury. It just threw him off kilter. One time I suggested that he have a little conversation with his boo-boo to get some distance. I remember him looking down at his injury and going, "High pain." And immediately his face softened and there was a letting go. Know that it's a daily practice. I think it's very important not to compartmentalize our spirituality to 1 hour a week at church, a few hours a week at yoga classes, or when the house is all clean and together, nothing's disturbing us, we can finally sit in meditation. Everything in front of us is our practice in every moment. It's driving to the church, it's cleaning the house, it's interacting with other drivers. We don't have to go far to look for ways to do our practice. In the words of Rumi, today, like every other day, we awake, suspended between desire and fear. Don't retreat to your study. Dance with the music given. Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. These are words from the Dalai Lama. As human beings, we all want to be happy and free from misery. We have learned that the key to happiness is inner peace. The greatest obstacles to inner peace are disturbing emotions such as anger, attachment, fear, and suspicion, while love and compassion and a sense of universal responsibility are the sources of peace and happiness. Our prime purpose in this life is to help others. And if you can't help them, at least don't hurt them.
One of my favorite poets, William Stafford, used one of my favorite words, yes, as a title to a short poem that reminds us to pay attention. It could happen any time. Tornado, earthquake, Armageddon. It could happen. Or sunshine, love, salvation. It could, you know, that's why we wake and look out. No guarantees in this life, but some bonuses, like morning, like right now, like noon, like evening. That's enough, is it not? The art of being happy lies in the power of extracting happiness from common things. That's Henry Ward Beecher. But remember, a few months ago, when political leaders in our country spoke in complete and comprehensible sentences, well, I turned on the radio yesterday, and I heard a familiar voice from the distant past saying sensible things. I soon realized it was Joe Biden. Terry Gross was talking to Joe Biden, who was getting an award, and she was doing what journalists do, playfully prying and kind of trying to create a binary that was, these people are good and these people aren't, and they touched on some tragic parts of Biden's life. You probably know his wife and daughter died in a wreck just before he became a senator at the age of 30. The age of not quite 30. He was elected and then had to wait a few weeks until he turned 30. so he could begin his public service in the Senate. His young sons were grievously injured in the same wreck. And just a couple of years ago, he lost a son to cancer. And Joe himself had almost died from an aneurysm. Terry Gross was painting a picture of how hard life had been and how tough the Senate must be, how divided and nasty. And Joe said, no, it was never hard. And the Senate wasn't like that. A lot of my colleagues, Republican colleagues, Democrats, saved my sanity. They were incredibly empathetic. Never once was I in a situation where there wasn't some degree of sympathy or empathy. But it's because we used to know one another. We used to eat with one another, and we'd have lunch with one another. You know, it's awful hard when I learn that, God forbid, your mother has breast cancer, or you have a child who's a drug addict, or you have a serious deficiency in that you stutter badly like I do, or whatever. It's hard to dislike you when I know the human frailty and the pain that you're suffering. You can disagree, and extensively disagree, but you don't then question motive. You actually embrace one another in times of difficulty. He goes on and says, when I first got to the Senate, one of the meanest guys I ever met was the senator from the state of Arkansas, McClellan. He used to eat privately in the Senate dining room. I walked in. He was eating by himself. I was 30 years old, and I walked over and said, hello, Senator. And he put his hand to me and said, hey, you're the kid. Just had your tractor trailer. Just killed your wife and daughter, right? And your kids are in tough shape. And I felt like reaching out and ripping his Adam's apple out of his throat. And I said, yeah. He said, you're mad at me, aren't you? And I said, I don't have any more to say, Mr. Chairman. He said, well, let me tell you. When I was your age, I was riding home. They didn't used to pay to get our family home, and my wife and kids were in the Ozarks heading home, and she dropped dead. She had an aneurysm. And then, he said, my son worked for Aramco. 1966, I was on a NATO trip. I got a call saying he got crushed in an oil rig, and he died. And I was going to meet his body. I was going to meet the casket at the airport in Little Rock. And while I was waiting for the plane to unload, I heard a crash at the gate. My other son, on a motorcycle, was killed on the way in. So he looked at me. The meanest man Joe Biden had ever met looked at him and said, so son, work. Just work. Joe says, you don't know the pain other people have had. I'll bet you I won't do it. If I surveyed all of you, every one of you has had tremendous loss. Remember what the Dalai Lama says, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. Well, I have to mention Harold and Maude. I think most of you know the movie, Harold and Maude. There was a point in this movie from 1971. They'd had most of their adventures, including stealing a tree from a city street and taking it back to the forest to plant. That day has come to an end, and they're sitting by the water. Harold is telling Maude that his mom has set him up with another date, and he's clearly not enthused. Well, be kind, she says. I've lived a long time, Harold, seen evil as well as good, and it's been my experience that kindness is what the world sorely lacks. As Maude is talking and looking out to sea, Harold looks down at her hand in his, and we see, ever so briefly, a number tattooed on her skin. We see that she is a Holocaust survivor. Maude doesn't notice that Harold saw this, but Harold's visibly shocked. And then she says, oh, look, and she points, and Harold looks out to sea, and a seagull, a simple seagull, flies across the red sky. Maude says, Dreyfus once wrote that on Devil's Island he would see the most glorious birds. Many years later in Brittany, he realized they'd only been seagulls. She just smiles that peaceful smile at Harold and looks back out to sea. To me, they will always be glorious birds. Again, then, the art of being happy lies in the power of extracting happiness from common things. Now, I knew Ahmad in real life. I chose to serve as a hospice chaplain when I was finishing my time in seminary 20 years ago. My parents had died long before, and I suspected that any deep issues I had around their deaths needed to surface and would arise in the hospice setting. As I wrote that, I realized that in 2 weeks, I will be older than my mom ever was. She died really young. My Maud was actually named Margaret, had been in and out of the hospice for nearly a year when we met. Something kept her going and kept her vivacious, and there was only one deep concern she had not resolved in her life. She was worried about her adult kids who had turned fundamentalist. Now, she was not a Unitarian nor a Universalist, well, maybe a bit of a Universalist without the label, but she was far from a fundamentalist. She was worried about these kids, that they'd been trying to convert her to their fear-based theology. I visited many times, and every time I got to the care facility, she wasn't in her room. I had to hunt her down. Every time, she was off helping others. And she wasn't one of those annoying helpers who just got in the way of staff. They quickly learned that she was thoughtful and would get out of the way when she needed to, and only brought important things to their attention. She was a gem. She never complained, and after a while, she let go of that worry. We had a plan that allowed her to be true to her beliefs and not get entangled in her offspring's fear. On my last visit, I stood with her children, her grown children, and a grandchild of hers around her bed while they prayed in ways that would have offended her a few weeks prior to that. She wasn't bothered at all by then. She had a soft smile on her face when she breathed her last breath, as peaceful a death as anyone could imagine. The granddaughter, 12 or 13 at the time, wanted to talk, and she and I went out to the garden of this nursing home. In that beautiful, amazing way that young people can do, she just turned to me and said, "What happens when you die?" As if I had the authority to tell her. It's fair to say instead that I went fishing with gentle questions to try to discover her framework. What could I say that would be helpful to her in that moment of loss? How could I be in a constructive conversation with this child? She was incredulous about her parents' beliefs, but surrounded by them, smothered by them to some extent, she knew that her grandmother was not like that. Her parents meant well and were facing this loss at that very moment on their own. In that garden of common things, I think it was zinnias and a sad goldfish pond, as I recall. But what I really mean is, in that garden of glorious things, I asked what she thought her grandmother believed. I was honored to be the bridge that connected her curiosity to her grandmother's individuality. We sort of skipped a generation. We talked of Margaret as only people with fond memories can. I learned a lot from Margaret and Maud, and a bit from that granddaughter. One of my heroes, Fred Rogers. He wrote, "I remember one of my seminary professors saying, people who were able to appreciate others, who looked for what was good and healthy and kind, were about as close as you could get to God, to the eternal good. And those people who were always looking for what was bad about themselves and others were really on the side of evil." As a side note, Unitarian Universalists sometimes have trouble with the concept of evil. the Presbyterian Fred Rogers understood it as a valuable thing to talk about. He continues, that's what evil wants, he would say. Evil wants us to feel so terrible about who we are and who we know that we'll look with condemning eyes on anybody who happens to be with us at the moment. Fred says, I encourage you instead to look for the good where you are and embrace it. Same things, right? The common things, ultimate but common things, life, death, loss, how we perceive and react to the world around us. One more thing about Harold and Maude, because they provide this other example. Thinking about when they stole the tree. Now, this process involves also stealing a truck, borrowing a shovel, and a highway patrolman on a motorcycle, who I recently learned was Tom Skerritt, using a different name. They encountered the patrolman 3 times, and by the 3rd encounter, he's quite agitated and blustery, because Maude will just say, okay, we'll be off then, and speed away, and he's at a loss. So he's quite agitated. Maude says, oh, don't get officious. You're not yourself when you're officious. That's the curse of a government job. Indeed, officiousness is an option. Creating or seeking rules and formulas to make sense of the world, to try to get a grip on it, to control. Harold's mother in the movie is certainly controlling, more than the patrolman, but she's also inattentive and self-absorbed. Just a model of disconnection. Maude writes her own rule book. She's certain how she's going to do things, but she's also had the toughest life of anyone in that movie. And yet her character is the personification of a vital, well-lived life. Happiness hides in the common seagulls when you see them as glorious birds. One more note from my favorite poet, William Stafford, reminding us of common things and paying attention. Some of the cars are yellow that go by, those you look at, so glimmering when light glances at their passing. Think of that. Someone will like me, maybe. The tan ones don't care, the blue have made a mistake, the white haven't tried, but the yellow. You turn your head. Hope lasts a long time if you're happy. And that, in my heart, is why I wake up and look out and pay attention for the common things all around us at every moment that are a source of happiness and contentment. There's just this one life to live. May we live it fully.
Here we go. Don't be shy. Just let your feelings roll on by. And don't wear fear. Oh, nobody will know you're there. Lift your head. Let your feelings out instead. And don't let your feelings roll on by, 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 on by. You know, love is better than a song. nobody will know you're there. Lift your head, let your feelings out instead. Don't be shy, let your feelings roll on by. On by, 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 on by.
Reach out, if you're willing, to find a clammy hand to put in your clammy hand. What an amazing life. Remember when you have been near babies in your life, perhaps your own, and their hands felt like this, hot and clammy. And of course, who knows what they were covered with. But you were once that baby too, and somebody held your hand, and they might have thought, ooh, ick, sticky. Or they might have thought, ah, life, life growing and thriving, juicy, refulgent life. And that's you, and you, and you, and all of us together. It's hard sometimes when the summer beats down upon us, when the sun is above the clouds and we're turning to stew. But I remind you, stew is delicious. So is life, and so may you be. Go in peace, return in love, have a wonderful summer. Amen.